Welcome to Party Politics, a podcast to prep you with understandable political chatter for your next cocktail or dinner party this weekend. I'm Jay Iyer, political science professor from Texas Southern University.
And I'm Brandon Rottinghouse, a political science professor from the University of Houston. Every week, Jay and I get together at our favorite place to talk politics. So listen in, and by the end of it, we hope you'll sound like a current events genius. Well, so Jay, there's been a lot of things happening internationally as well as domestically this week. So what's on your radar?
Well, we are in the middle of the G20 summit, right?
So sounds like a Gatorade thing, but
exactly,
it's not right.
It does, doesn't it? Yeah, well, it's refreshing, but not quite the same way. So G20 are the group of 20 nations. They're considered sort of the economic and political leaders of the world and disproportionately cover Western European countries, the U.S., the United Kingdom, but also include large emerging powers like India and some countries in the Middle East that have oil resources. It's an opportunity and a time for global communities to get together. The leadership gets together. And it's a big test for the president to show how he can be a leader in the global community.
I think you're right. And the president really isn't the center of this in lots of ways. I mean, there's been some friction about the climate change accords. And so he's going to get an earful, I think, from several of our allies on that. There's also risks, I think, for him domestically, because he's going to meet with some of these individuals, especially Vladimir Putin, who not only is a foil on, you know, Saturday Night Live, but also in real life has been accused of tampering in the election. So there's a domestic risk for the president, but there's also an international risk. If he ends up getting too close to Putin, then it makes it look like perhaps he's sidling with this kind of military regime in Russia that's pushing too far, too fast on a bunch of ways. So it's a lot of issues, I think, and lots of risk for the president if they don't handle it properly.
Yeah, and it's also, I think, a situation for President Trump where, you know, his brand of non-globalism, for lack of a better word, sort of a neo-isolationist position that he wants to take, is in sharp contrast to this interdependent global way of approaching government that had been the U.S. norm, right? This idea of Pax Americana, where the U.S. is kind of a global leader, is taking a backseat. So that's a different approach. We'll see how it goes, and we'll see moving forward. What else happened this week of great interest, Brandon?
Well, speaking of the center of the political universe, Donald Trump, he sent out a very maligned tweet that had him in his old WWF days clotheslining somebody who had a CNN logo juxtaposed over their head. This got a lot of attention, and he received lots of pushback on this. What do you make of this?
I think we can all safely say that in the grand scheme of things, this might be some of the least offensive thing that the president
maybe
put out there.
It's creative, though, too.
It is creative, yeah, right. But I do think what it is sort of the larger question of presidential behavior and decorum. It's obviously not that. But I think there's a larger issue about sort of the president targeting or seeming to take a more adversarial role with the media and one media agency in particular. You just can't imagine any other president ever doing that in this way. And I think that's what gives people pause.
I mean, it's hard. I mean, Harry Truman had his beef with the press, right? But he would do something like write a letter and put it in a desk without showing anybody, right? And we're well past that. But I do think you're right that the war on the media has become too aggrandized, and I think that it's only really selling the president's message to a very narrow base. And that's a dangerous thing, I think, for him politically, but it's also, I think, just problematic for the system that we've got designed here that needs to have this balance and requires the media to do its job. So you can either work with them or work against them, but they're not going to go away.
The other big news, I think, this week is this ongoing question as to whether or not Anthony Kennedy, who is one of the 9 Supreme Court justices, the center of the court right now, he is that swing vote. He's been the 5th vote on pretty much every major decision. There are strong indications that he very well may be retiring, if not immediately, within the next 3 years, which can have massive implications on the balance of the court, and it would provide President Trump with another appointee.
I think this would be a tremendous battle that would potentially bring government to a halt, because the fight over the swing vote on the Supreme Court is really a fight over some of the biggest issues that we're going to find politically, right? Redistricting, you're going to have issues with respect to voter ID. So these kinds of rights that are going to be fought up to the courts are going to be in play, and there's no way that the sides are going to give in.
Absolutely. And the midterm elections become that much more critical if the Democrats can take over the Senate, for example. That changes the entire calculus and the kind of justice we may get. And let's not forget, the precedent has now been set. Any appointment that occurs within that 1 year, 18-month period is likely not to get confirmed, will likely get pushed off to the next presidential election cycle.
Yeah, we're kicking the Supreme Court can down the road, and that's not good policy.
Exactly.
So another thing that happened this week on the international stage, on Independence Day, there was a launch from North Korea of a series of missiles that at least it reportedly could potentially inflict damage on the United States. Now, the president has said that he won't establish a bright line of actions that would be problematic if the North Koreans crossed it, but he did threaten to pursue certain penalties, or Nikki Haley did threaten to pursue certain penalties against countries who did business with the, quote, outlaw regime, unquote. And she also implied that the U.S. was ready to use force if needed. So how do we read this, and how does this affect our sort of perception of the president as a foreign policy actor?
I think North Korea has been the problem that just has vexed multiple administrations over time. It's really an issue where the Chinese government have the maximum ability to influence and have just shown an unwillingness to, because they're looking at it from a perspective of 2 to 3 million Koreans pouring over their border, creating a different situation for them, a refugee crisis for them, an instability for the Chinese. And so from their perspective, having somebody that they can control and power in North Korea makes the most sense. It's a difficult situation. The real challenge, I think, is not the question of whether we think North Korea is going to suddenly send missiles to the U.S. It's really more about the expansion of proliferation. You already know they're nuclear capable. If they have warhead capability and missile capability, marketing and selling that to a regime or another entity or a terrorist group that wants to come after the United States becomes a bigger issue. And so how this is all dealt with is how, part of it is how we deal with the Chinese. And that really difficult on-again, off-again relationship the president has had with the Chinese premier, I think, is a real question. And some of that might get answered in the G20 summit.
Yeah, I think you're right. And the question is whether or not the Trump administration is prepared to lead on this. And I think that the fact that he's using Twitter as a way to ballast against the potential blowback internationally from some action the U.S. might take is problematic. The fact that the U.S. doesn't have an ambassador confirmed to South Korea is one problem. And I think that the kind of waiting for North Korea to fail or waiting for their weapon system to malfunction is not a policy. That's not a good choice. So they need something more firm, and they need to have it fairly quickly. Well, so speaking of Independence Day, Jay, we had some fireworks come up during an interesting Twitter interaction with NPR and a bunch of followers.
Well, if there was ever a reason or justification for why we need public radio, you just got it. So NPR decided, and it has been a tradition, National Public Radio, to essentially, in a form of tweets, 140 characters, tweet out the Declaration of Independence, that document that is literally just below the U.S. Constitution in terms of hallowed status for any American, right? Well,
What could go wrong, Jay?
Exactly. What could go right. wrong, right? This is a founding document of the Republic. Anyone should recognize that. Well, apparently a lot of folks didn't, and a lot of people viewed it as an attack against President Trump, and viewed it as an attack, you know, references to tyranny and references to the need to overthrow a dictator who doesn't listen to his people was viewed as NPR's attempt to attack President Trump.
Right. I think it speaks to a couple of things. I mean, first is the woeful state of civic education. And I think, too, that...
just a couple of political science teachers telling you that.
No,
this is a reality.
Right. This is not us lecturing to you. Yeah, this is a real problem. And this, I think, typifies that. The other is that I think that we are in such polarized times that people will find partisanship anywhere, and we could tweet
Absolutely.
Out Harry Potter and it would be like thought to be, you know, an attack on one or the other of the party. So I think that's a real problem. And I don't know what the solution is except to say that everybody just needs to calm down.
Yeah, exactly. And frankly, you know, read the Declaration of Independence. You know what I blame entirely?
Every 4th of July, right?
Exactly. At least, you know, when Schoolhouse Rock went away, I think that pretty much did it. People don't know the Constitution or the preamble or the Declaration of Independence anymore.
We need to make it hip again. Like, we need a song from Drake or something.
Exactly.
Just make it cool.
Exactly.
Constitution cool.
We're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we're going to talk about the President's Commission on Voter Fraud.
So, Jay, one of the big things that has happened this week is that there's been a dust-up with the President's Advisory Commission on Electoral Integrity, which is set out by the president by executive order to investigate illegal voting. So the president has claimed without evidence that millions of people voted illegally in the 2016 election. So this commission is designed to essentially do this investigating. But talk about Independence Day. You've got 44 states, that, including D.C., that have refused to give over information. What is the center of this crisis? What is happening?
This is an interesting issue here, because what's coming about is the president basically had said that there were people who were not supposed to be or not allowed to vote, they were actually voting. And so one of the things is they wanted to do a comprehensive look at the voter rolls. Where the controversy has come about is that normally when you apply for your voting registration information to get registered to vote, that information contains a couple of things. It's obviously got your name and your date of birth, et cetera. Also has your social security number in order to show proof of eligibility to vote. Well, what's happened here is that the president's commission has required and requested everything. And so it's been interpreted by some as a sort of the big state coming in, trying to take over and trying to big brother looking over to see who voted and who didn't, kind of who's naughty, who's nice, so to speak. And you've gotten a lot of pushback. Now, I think it's probably important for everyone to understand to sort of take a step back. The who voted in an election is in fact public data, right, Brandon?
Yeah. And that's what they were asking for, was public data, although states collect this differently. I think you're right. Some of the cases in some of the states really balked at the idea of sending, like, Social Security numbers or felony convictions. So these things are thought to be at least moderately private, even though in some cases they're not. So I think a lot of states are worried that this is an exaggeration of this politicization of the right to vote. And there are critics who say that this is essentially the White House taking the country down the position, down the trail of trying to limit those rights by exaggerating the fact that voter fraud is happening and then using that as a pretext to clamp down on people's rights to vote.
So one of the interesting things, and most people don't realize this, is that while the Constitution guarantees your right to vote, the mechanism by which who is and isn't eligible to vote can vary by state. So in many states, for example, someone who's been convicted of a felony is not legally allowed to vote. Mm-hmm. And in some states, they are. And so that, I think, comes into play here. What kind of information is required in order to be registered? Some states require Social Security data. Some states do not. And that comes into play here. So part of it ends up being is that we have this odd system where there's a federal right to vote, but the states themselves interpret it in different ways. But at the end of the day, I think what this really is a question of trust, right? Do these individual states feel confident that the federal government, and in this case, the Trump administration, is looking at this voter information for the purposes of creating a better system, or one in which they are trying to identify problems that may or may not actually exist?
Yeah, of these 44 states, right, they're red states and blue states. And so it's not like it's a democratic phenomenon where they're rejecting the Trump administration's overtures. And I think you're right. I mean, these rights are really held at the state level. And we've seen so much litigation involving the states and how they have tried to narrow or expand the right to vote. And so this is really where the future of voting rights will be and how exactly people are able to execute these rights, and with the effect on who gets to be elected will be critical and will be drawn directly from these kinds of fights.
I think one of the more interesting examples of a state that is complying is what's happening in Texas, where the Secretary of State has essentially said, look, I'm going to give you the publicly available information, which is who voted. Yeah. I'm not going to give you anything else.
Yeah.
So that, to me, I think is the most plausible way to move forward on this. At the end of the day, I think the statistical analysis that's been done on it, in-person voter fraud is a really non-existent problem.
Yeah.
And so I'm not sure what this really does other than, as you say, get everyone riled up and everyone get in their sort of partisan positions, and it gets taken from there.
Yeah, and it's not clear what the commission really is going to do, right? And that's, I think, part of it. People are worried that it's going to be used for some partisan purpose. But even if it weren't, the committee's not set up to really deal with this. They have no full-time staff. They've got only a nominal number of Democrats. And so it doesn't look like they're really serious about investigating this. And I think a lot of people see this as very complex work and reject the idea that the Trump administration can handle this because it's run directly from the executive office of the president.
Well, we're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, we're going to talk about how this particular issue really can affect your life.
All right, Jay. So we broke down some of the details about the president's commission on electoral integrity. Now, what do we take from this? Why should people care about this?
Great question, Brandon. When you get right down to it, the most fundamental right we have is that right to vote. It is something that is one of the few things sort of enshrined in the U.S. Constitution. And making sure that that process has integrity, transparency, and is protected is really, really important. And so I understand the concern that secretaries of state have had. We want to make sure that we have a system that's fair, that's equitable for everyone, and doesn't keep anyone out.
I think that's exactly right. You've got a problem where too many people don't vote, and making it harder for people to vote, or even the premise that when they do vote, that they might have their information splashed all over the front pages, is something that might prevent people from going to the polls. The other is that there are concerns that election tampering are on the rise. Now, this could be something that, again, is connected to the fear about what the administration might do with this. But the House committee this week voted to defund the U.S. Election Commission, Assistance Commission. And this is an agency that's tasked with certifying voting machines and determining best practices. This is something we cared about after the 2000 election and seems to have gone away. But it's a fundamental issue and needs to be handled properly and with care.
Well, we'll be back next week with more party politics. If you like this political chatter, make sure to check out our Texas-centric episodes, too. They're available every Friday afternoon, just like these episodes. Thanks to Houston Public Media, our producers Daisha Clay, Laura Lucas, Edel Howland, and to our engineer extraordinaire, the Big H, Todd Hultzlander.
Be sure to subscribe to us on iTunes or from wherever you get your podcasts, and don't forget to leave us a review. That'll help other people find the show. Follow us on Twitter with the hashtag PartyPoliticsPod, or you can email us at partypoliticspod@houstonpublicmedia.org.
I'm Jay Iyer.
And I'm Brandon Rottinghouse. We'll see you next week.